Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Republic Education Call for the United States of America and our Republican form of self-governance for February 27th, 2024, at the new time, 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Thank you all for those of you that have gotten on the call on time tonight. I am Phyllis Marie, and I will start this call with a devotional, and it is... Get my book open here.
Okay. Thank you to everyone who joined the call on time. Was an ever so kind verbal dart to me, wasn't it?
No, not intentionally. No, happy birthday, Paul.
Thank you.
All right, this comes from Psalm 73. Verse 23, and 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. Keep your eyes on me. Waves of adversity are washing over you, and you feel tempted to give up. As your circumstances consume more and more of your attention, you are losing sight of me. Yet, I am always with you, holding you by your right hand. I am fully aware of your situation, and I will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able to bear. Your gravest danger is worrying about tomorrow. If you try to carry tomorrow's burdens today, you will stagger under the load and eventually fall flat. You must discipline yourself to live within the boundaries of today. It is in the present moment that I walk close to you, helping you carry burdens. Keep your focus on my present in the present. And we the Republic, we the people of the Republic are peaceful, lawful, and private. And our Declaration says, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And I know this is a new time tonight, and so we're probably going to be missing a few people for a little while. And hopefully... they'll join us in due time here. I just want to mention that if any of you get my notices and you decide that you don't want to get them in the future, please let me know to remove you from the list rather than blocking my notices. It's just as easy to send me an email and say you don't want to be received anymore. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Daryl, who just joined us. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, Phyllis. Thanks for the reminder. I was looking at the clock, and I was thinking 7, and the next thing, the phone made a little message. Am I sharing screen? Do you know? I thought I had it on, and then.
There's nothing on there at the moment, but it has your name on there.
Okay, well, I don't know why. I had it on share screen. I moved it up, and then it didn't, and then it, like, it disappeared. So I don't know if what's going on here. Let's see.
I don't see any shared screen at all.
Here, maybe this, here it
just
is.
Saying.
Okay. There, we're getting something. Okay. Yeah, I didn't get this opened. But anyway, well, welcome everyone, and happy birthday, Paul. And thank you for your commitment to come on and share. And tonight we're going to be talking about basically the importance of getting your national status established, and you know, and to basically confirm it on the record with you know, ordering a passport card and having that for your identification and getting that into the record, as this is a this will be a real key component when it comes right down to, you know, if you, you know, come into a traffic stop or, you know, go into an official building or anything like that where they want your identification, then when you present that, the Federal Secretary of State, which is Anthony Blinken at the time, would be where you would send it, and that's on the sample down at the bottom of the notice for tonight. But it is an important thing to have in your possession so that they will recognize you as a national and not as a United States citizen that is held under the presumption of a volunteer slave, you know, in this here corporate system. And we're going to kind of go over some of this here document, this here National Citizenship Handbook. I got to get it downloaded here. And we finished up at page 12 last week, and we could maybe review that a little bit. You know, it's basically, you know, we went over what is citizenship and the difference and talking about the definition of state and, you know, allegiance and then the slaughterhouse cases, which are very clear, which talk about the duality of citizenship. And I'll read a little bit from a case, the slaughterhouse case of 1872, which if you have this here, here I'll have it up here on the screen here in a little bit. But anyway, it talks about the primary holding that the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment is limited to federal citizenship rather than extending to state citizenship. And that's basically a state citizen is, you know, basically the where you were born is where you would be kind of recognized as where your allegiance should be with your community within the boundaries of that state. Even though we're part of the 50 United States of America, but yet we are in this here area of a country that has many jurisdictions. And to be identified as a national basically recognizes you as a sovereign that has their God-given rights, you know, that are preserved and protected, you know, by the Constitution. And for those that are in places of authority, are all required to take an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So there's a duty and an obligation there when they are put into a public office that they need to operate within the limits of that authority that is granted to them. But I'll read here a little bit off of this here, this case. It says, not only may a man be a citizen of the United States without being a citizen of a state, but an important element is necessary to convert the former into the latter. So that's conforming a citizen of the United States into a citizen of a state. But he must reside within a state to make him a citizen of it. But it is only necessary that he should be born or naturalized in the United States to be a citizen of the Union. It is quite clear that there is a citizenship of the United States and a citizenship of a state, which are distinct from each other and which depend upon different characteristics or circumstances in the individual. And this distinction goes all the way back to 1872. A citizen of the United States is a federal citizen. That's recognized basically with the 14th Amendment, or a citizen of the federal government in Washington, D.C. A state citizen, on the other hand, is a member of one of the states. So this is kind of what we need to really comprehend, you know, to the point of applying this, because this is very important when it comes to determining what jurisdiction or what laws are going to be applied to us. And here I finally got it up. Okay. And we'll talk about this here, and then how we get tied into basically this feudal system, as we're operating under a feudal system. And we are basically being controlled by the Lord of the Manor as tenants, or as you know, subjects of the crown or subject of the corporation. So we'll try to break this down a little bit. I'm no expert on the subject, but I will share what I have learned and comprehended. And if I misspeak on anything, please correct me, because I do not want to share anything that is in error. We need to know the truth, because it is the truth that's going to hold the ground and to set us free when we exercise it in basically in obedience to Zechariah chapter 8, verse 16, where it says we are to execute the judgment of truth. So we must know the truth, and then we'll have peace in our gates. So the American Civil War, which was from Britannica.com, was in 1861 to 1865. The American Civil War was called the War Between the States, a four-year war between the United States and seven southern states that seceded from the Union and formed the Confederate States of America. And the succession of the southern states in chronicle order, which is, you know, South Carolina, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, Virginia, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina, in 1860 and 61, and the ensuing outbreak of the armed hostilities were the accumulation of decades of growing sectional friction over slavery. Between 1815 and 1861, the economy of the northern states was rapidly modernizing and diversifying. And the Civil War was fought between the United States and the 11 southern states, historically over slavery and the treatment of the Negro race. But what we're going to get into seeing is how this circumstance of this war was basically to ratify or to bring about the second 13th Amendment and the 14th Amendment, and which set up a dual citizenship and basically made each one of us in the presumption of this here federal citizen. And this is where we need to know the difference and why we need to declare our correct political status. As even in the UN Charter, in the first paragraph, it talks about that everyone has the right to make his own political determination. And that's where we are recognized in that proper capacity as one of the people of the United States of America, or as a national, which is also really synonymous to a member of a state or a state citizen. And the 13th Amendment was brought in, the second 13th Amendment was brought in 1865, which states, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a manner of punishment for crime whereof a party shall have been convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Now, this is pretty important to understand, you know, their jurisdiction and where their jurisdiction applies. So then after the Civil War, the 13th Amendment was ratified at the end to end slavery within the jurisdiction of the states. Notice also the plural use of the word jurisdiction. This amendment directly overrides the state citizens' ability to own slaves, and that at this time the United States referred to the states collectively was this sufficient, however, to free the slaves of our country? That's a question. And then, you know, they brought in just right after that in 1868, they brought in the 14th Amendment. Now, here's an article. It's a history of the history of law article regarding the 14th Amendment. It says some southern states begin actively passing laws that restrict the rights of former slaves after the Civil War. The Congress responds to the 14th Amendment, designed to place limits on states' powers as well as protect civil rights, to be remediated to the Union after the Civil War. Southern states, they had to ratify the 14th Amendment. So this little commentary that Devin put together, he writes, after the southern states lost the Civil War and the 13th Amendment was ratified, the southern states were creating laws that limit the rights of their Negro inhabitants who were freed, but had no standing against their state. In response to this, Congress proposed the 14th Amendment, and in order for the southern states to be allowed back into the Union, they had to ratify it as well. So that was so what was all in the 14th Amendment, and what did it all include? Now here, this is where they established this dual citizenship, and it's very well confirmed when we go into basically that U.S. versus Cruikshank, or the Jim Crow laws, and then there were several court cases that really confirmed that and brought that into application. But to understand how they created this dual citizenship is really important. So in 1868, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and is a real key word there, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Another very key word, reside, and we'll go into that here after a bit. No state shall make or enforce any law that shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. There is a key point to bear here in mind. The United States before the 14th Amendment was used in a plural sense to refer to the states collectively as a whole. So, however, in this amendment, it says the jurisdiction. Now, that's specific. That's a certain jurisdiction. That's not all-encompassing. The jurisdiction thereof. In quotes, not their jurisdiction thereof. A singular jurisdiction entity. This is further backed by mentioning the states separately. Now, this is really key to understand, you know, how they talked about in the 13th Amendment, they talked about their jurisdiction, any place subject to their jurisdiction. Now, that's plural. But here, and the jurisdiction, that's singular, that is specific. On top of that, this is the first time we've seen the creation of the U.S. citizenship as it pertains to a singular entity and which there is jurisdiction. In short, since the Negroes were being invaded by the individual states, the federal government's solution was to create a citizen of the United States political status to grant largely to the Negroes. Where primary jurisdiction over them is Congress in Washington, D.C., and not the several states. What sort of impact did this have on our citizenship laws? Now, this is what we have to keep in mind, that the first 10 amendments were brought in along with the Constitution. But all the rest of the amendments after that were really just brought in under the authority of Congress, where you'll look at all the rest of those amendments, and it will basically state that Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. So this is how they plan on enforcing it, through legislation. And remember what we talked about last week in 1863 when Lincoln exercised this here Executive Order 100. And really, the executive orders really apply basically to that branch. It don't apply to the people out here in the territories, but yet what they did through this here executive order was declared court-martial at that time when Congress went sine die and a number of the congressmen didn't show up. And so in order to bring them back in, they had to ratify these 13th and 14th Amendments, and Lincoln commanded them back under court-martial. But this is kind of how they ratify, as they ratify, you know, things like control over a land or a region is through war. They ratify it and basically raise their flag over the land. And I don't know if anybody remembers in Kosovo, and this was under Bill Clinton, when they invaded, you know, Kosovo and took it over. And one of the things that happened was they took down the Kosovo flag and they raised the UN flag over Kosovo. And this is basically, you know, recognizing the jurisdiction or the authority that that's gonna be ruling over that land. But this is how the flag that we recognize here, a flag of peace versus a military flag, with that gold fringe around it, is recognizing a military flag. We are basically, it's a war flag. It's recognizing, you know, a type of jurisdiction. And so they're holding us under that authority, and that's why in the courts, you'll always see that gold fringe flag, you know, with a gold eagle or a ball on top, which recognizes the jurisdiction of that court. So do we belong in that court? Not as a national. They have no authority over a national. They only have authority over that citizen of the United States, that citizen slash subject, which is subject to that jurisdiction thereof under that 14th Amendment. So this is important to understand how they're doing this and how they are controlling the people through holding them in a specific political status. And this is why it's so important that we comprehend this to the point that we can apply it and recognize, you know, our superior authority, because, like I've said many times, the created can never be greater than the creator, and the people created the government, and the government does not have authority to impose things violating their rights, which they're doing through statute today. And but all public officers, you know, when they take an oath, that's basically their quid pro quo contract with the people, that they will operate within that authority, because they're sitting there with only delegated powers. And those delegated powers is been taken to mean that they can rule over the people. Well, rights, nobody has a right to take over someone else. And but when those rights are trespassed, there should be remedy, and that's why even the First Amendment, you know, talks about the right that we have a right to redress of grievances. That when we are when our rights are trespassed upon, you know, we have the right to basically defend that and to protect it. So here's a few cases here, and we won't go through each one of these, but I'd encourage everyone to take a read of this here and to really study it and understand it, the difference. But this, in this case, Colgate versus Harvey, in this here first paragraph of it, it says, the dual character of citizenship is made plainly apparent. There is two, that is to say, a citizen of the United States is ipso facto and at the same time a citizen of a state in which he resides. And while the 14th Amendment does not create a national citizenship, it has the effect of making a citizenship paramount or dominant instead of a derivative or dependent upon state citizenship. Remember what it said that, you know, in the what I read earlier, there's a clear distinction of the two, and there are two different jurisdictions. But you can have a state citizenship and then also, you know, be subject, you know, into that federal realm, you know, if you've, you know, got presumed contracts or if you've got a contract with it, and be subject to that jurisdiction. And I'll go on here to the second paragraph. There's a few court cases here. We have hitherto considered it as it has been argued from the point of view that the Constitution, as it stood prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment, but to avoid all misapprehension, we briefly direct our attention to that the 14th Amendment, for the purpose of pointing out, it has been frequently done in the past, how completely it broadened the national scope of government under the Constitution by causing citizenship of the United States to be paramount and dominant instead of being subordinate. And I'll read the little comment that Devin put down here. He said, years later, this case spells out the very nature of U.S. citizen political status. That when Bohr is paramount and dominant to state citizenship status. This is further backed by the definition of citizen, where it mentioned that citizens of the federal government were not considered state citizens in federal courts. Go back in history. Though, how did this dynamic really play out? So, this is, you know, something to, and they basically try to ratify this by bringing a case and then enforcing it and getting you to acknowledge. And what they did is, you know, they made the Negroes citizens of the United States, but then they didn't want to give them rights. So then there was a conflict between state citizenship and federal citizenship. So the second 13th Amendment basically made it very clear that, you know, where it talked about neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except for punishment of a crime or for a party shall have been duly convicted shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So here, that allows volunteer slavery. So the 13th Amendment opened that up. So when the 14th Amendment was brought in, they brought us in to basically get us involved in voting into this here corporate structure and then participating, you know, gradually through licensing and Social Security and all these different little programs to presume basically a unilateral contract because you're the only one that signed it. So that's voluntary. You voluntarily participated as a member of the corporation. And that's why voting in a federal election is really acknowledging that we are partakers in the operations of the corporation. And, you know, even though in our local state, you know, I believe as a national, you know, we really have, it's really a duty, you know, to basically select, you know, a constitutional sheriff as these elected officials to basically be there, you know, on behalf of the people. And this is where, you know, it needs to be returned back to, but in this de facto system, it's this here federal corporation that is paying the sheriffs, and then they're trying to, and then you've got the Bar Association basically instructing them as their legal counsel, you know, to basically operate within statute and not within the common law and recognizing the sovereign or the national or the state citizen as being superior, you know, to the status of this here 14th Amendment subject citizen, federal citizen, that is subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So here in Plessy versus Ferguson, this is where it starts with the segregation battle. It says it was a legal case in the U.S. Supreme Court on May 18, 1896, by the 7-1 majority, one justice did not participate. It advanced a controversial separate but equal doctrine for assessing constitutionality of racial segregation laws. Plessy v. Ferguson was the first major inquiry into the meaning of the 14th Amendment. 1868, Equal Protection Clause, which prohibits the states from denying equal protection of the laws to any person within their jurisdiction. Although the major opinion did not contain the phrase separate but equal, it gave constitutional sanction of laws designed to achieve racial segregation by means of separate and supposedly equal public facilities and service for African Americans and whites. To serve as a controlling judicial precedent, unless it's overturned by the Supreme Court in Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka in 1954. So as we know, the purpose of U.S. citizenship status was to grant the freed Negroes a citizenship that protected them from the actions and laws of the states. States did not like this, so they sought to segregate their own citizens from the Congress and created a U.S. citizenship. On top of the already highly racial tensions, these segregations were the Jim Crow laws. And we'll get into that here in a little bit. So, as we know, the purpose of the U.S. citizenship status was to grant the freed Negroes a citizenship that protected them from the actions and laws of the states. The states did not like this, so they sought a segregation of their own citizens, and Congress created a U.S. citizenship on top of the already highly tensioned. These segregations were the Jim Crow laws. Now, this case brought into the question whether the individual states had the right under the 14th Amendment and to separate their citizens from the citizens of the United States. And the court ruled in favor. Now, here's where the battle started with determining, you know, the division, which was Brown versus Board of Education. And this was in 1954, and which states, quote, says, when the case came before the Supreme Court in 1952, the court consolidated all five cases under the name Brown versus Board of Education. Marshall personally argued that the case before the court. Although he raised a variety of legal issues on appeal, most common one was the separate school systems for blacks and whites were inherently unequal and thus violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Further, relying on sociological tests such as the one performed by social scientist Kenneth Clark and other data, he also argued that segregated school systems had a tendency to make black children feel inferior to white children, thus which the system should not be legally permissible. Now, this landmark case, nearly 60 years later, destroyed the state's rights to separate their citizens from U.S. citizens. Both statuses were equalized, and the states were required to not treat their citizens any differently from U.S. citizens. But wait, this case was about race, not about political status, right? No, it had a whole lot more. What it really did is it made basically was to hold both sides, both statuses, under that voluntary servitude, which was permissible in the way the second 13th Amendment was written. Now, here's an important part, you know, where they talk about white citizen, but it has a little different twist. It's not about, not really just about color. It imposes a lot more of the meaning. In 1981, this is from the U.S. Code, the House.gov, talks about white and citizens. Equal rights under the law. Statements of equal rights. All persons within the jurisdiction of the United States shall have the same right in every state and territory to make and enforce contracts, to sue and be parties, give evidence, and to the full and equal benefit of all laws, the proceeding for the security of persons or property as is enjoyed by white citizens, and shall be subject to like punishment, pains, penalties, taxes, licensing, exactions of every kind, and to the other. And a little comment here that Devin put up. Further proof that the events during these times were matters of citizenship, not just race. This line exists in the United States Code, to this day. Notice how this code uses the verbiage from the 14th Amendment. Notice also the reference of white citizens, the opposite end of the aisle. These were the state citizens, not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. In the 14th Amendment, native citizens of the state that the states were trying to separate federal citizens from. But what are persons within the jurisdiction of the United States? Has anybody got any questions or thoughts at this time? Like to comment on, because this is where they considered basically a white citizen, that term that they used was synonymous to a state citizen and not subject to that federal jurisdiction of the 14th Amendment. Now, this is a very important part to understand, and this is why it's important that we declare our proper political status and get it recognized with the federal Secretary of State, which basically establishes your passport, which determines status if you are leaving, you know, into a foreign country or into another foreign jurisdiction. And that's basically what we're dealing with here. Even though Mexico and Canada are connected, you know, to the United States by land, it is a separate jurisdiction. And even within the United States lower 48 states, we have many jurisdictions within, this is a country of many jurisdictions. So that is why it's so important that we establish, you know, our proper political status. And that's why we've been encouraging you to do that. And if you have time during the week, on the notice tonight is the phone number and stuff to get on the radio ranch. And it's at 11 to 1 every from Monday to Saturday, 6 days a week, for them 2 hours. And then they have an after-hour discussion, too, if you want to, you know, bring up a subject or discuss things. And there's a lot of people stay on and talk about things. And this is where you can get a lot more in-depth comprehension of the importance of having our correct political status recognized. So here we're going to talk about the national of the United States in the United States Code definitions. In Section 22, it says the term national of the United States means a citizen of the United States, or B, a person who, though not a citizen of the United States, owes permanent allegiance to the United States. Now, you see how they define that, and they do these, they word these here things a little bit confusing, so if you don't identify the difference, this national of the United States, not just a national. National and state citizen are more synonymous to each other, but a national of the United States is here basically considered a citizen of the United States. So these are some, you know, things that we must really study and, you know why we believe what we believe, and we are able to defend our proper political status. And so in the little comment here, also within the United States Code is a definition of a national of the United States. And remember that this is a singular United States, not plural, so it refers to Congress and the federal government. This statement is interchangeable to a U.S. citizen and owes permanent allegiance to the United States and is wholly subject to it. These are persons within the jurisdiction of the United States. And as we've discussed, were largely freed Negroes at the time. And this is where Harriet Tubman says, you know, she said, I freed 1,000 slaves, but I could have freed thousands more if they only knew that they were slaves. And I can see this very clearly as the thought of the way people think today. Well, you know, I got a license and I got a house and I got a car. You know, I got to buy a license and I got to get a permit and I got to do all these fees and all this stuff. But, you know, I'm free to do what I want. Well, they're a slave and don't even know that they are a slave. So this is a real critical thing of, you know, knowing what our correct political status is so we recognize what we are not subject to. They try to hold us as we are subject to all these statutes, codes, rules, and regulations, but that only applies to that federal citizen. And you go into the definitions of United States, state, and municipality, it will be defined, which includes the District of Columbia, Guam, Puerto Rico, its territories and insular possessions, the Mariana Islands, and so on. But, you know, this will be in basically every statute book that you pick up, go into the first few pages, and it will show these definitions. And here's a case here regarding the citizenships, and this goes into the Dred Scott case, which was really another tide turner. But we'll go ahead and read this here. It says, the first section of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution begins with the words, quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside, unquote. It appears upon the face of this amendment, of the amendment, as well as from the history of the times, this is not intended to impose any new restrictions upon citizenship or prevent any person from becoming citizens by the fact of birth within the United States, who would thereby have become citizens according to the law existing before its adoption. It is declaratory in form and enabling the extent in effect. Its main purpose doubtlessly was, as has been often recognized by this court, to establish the citizenship of free Negroes, which had been denied in opinion delivered by Chief Justice Taney in Dred Scott versus Sanford in 1857. Now, recognize in 1857, that was before the Second 13th Amendment and the 14th and 15th Amendments that were brought in later, and put it beyond doubt that all blacks as well as whites born or naturalized within the United States of or in the within the jurisdiction of the United States are citizens of the United States. The Slaughterhouse case, but remember, now this citizen of the United States had a different meaning before the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment tried to join the two together. And so just be aware of that. And there's a bunch of cases, but the opening words, all persons born, are general, not to say universal, restricted only by place and jurisdiction and not by color or race, as was clearly recognized in all the opinions delivered in the Slaughterhouse cases above cited. Now, I don't know if did I miss something there? I thought, yeah, I did. We did cover that, the Slaughterhouse case. That's a very important distinction where they recognize the two different political statuses. Okay, here in the comment, this perspective on history is shared going all the way back to 1898 in U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark, 30 years after the passage of the 14th Amendment. This is a landmark case where the definition and extent of the 14th Amendment were really put to the test and confirms the impact of the Dred Scott decision. This also makes it quite clear that U.S. citizenship, while originally created for the freed Negroes, is not limited to them. And this is where they use this opportunity for the Second 13th Amendment and the 14th Amendment to bring everybody into the subject to the jurisdiction thereof status by combining the two. And this was really done through this legislation. And remember, even the 14th Amendment is very clear that where it says, you know, Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. And this goes back to 1863 when they put legislative law above common law. And this is a very important part. And this is done basically against this here second class or this here class of citizen of the United States subject to the jurisdiction thereof, and not the national or the state citizen, which is separate. But they went through all these cases and stuff, redefining this stuff to bring both political statuses into the jurisdiction thereof. So here's the Reconstruction Act from the Library of Congress. And then I'll read here, it says, at number 12, it says, in the latter half of 1860s, Congress passed a series of acts designed to address the question of rights, as well as how the southern states would be governed. These acts included the act creating the Freedmen's Bureau, the Civil Rights Act of 1866, the several Reconstruction Acts. The Reconstruction Acts established military rule over southern states until new governments could be formed. They also limited some former Confederate officials and military officers' right to vote and to run for public office. However, the later provisions were only temporary and soon rescinded for almost all those affected by them. Meanwhile, the Reconciliation Acts gave former male slaves the right to vote and hold public office. Congress also passed two amendments to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment made African American citizens and protected citizens from discriminatory state laws. Former Confederate states did not get congressional representation until they adopted the amendment. The 15th Amendment guaranteed African American men the right to vote. And now here, this is where the voter, okay, remember, this was all done in 1871. That's when they basically incorporated Washington and Arlington, and they made the Washington, D.C., and made that jurisdiction as a municipal corporation. And then that's where they warehoused our later, you know, this is, you know, where they warehouse the birth certificate, which they hold us basically as recognized under that jurisdiction of the basically the citizen of the United States political status, because it is our name that they are looking at being subject to the jurisdiction thereof, through registration and licensing and all these here attachments that make us subject to that jurisdiction thereof. And this is why, again, it's so important to understand the difference between a citizen of the United States and a national. or a state citizen, and the authority difference between the two. And a voter basically is a member or participant, like in an election, but an elector, you know, it is basically superior, you know, they give us actually selections, not elections. And they kind of choose who, you know, they want to be run, and that's a whole other subject. But in the little commentary here, he goes straight from the horse's mouth that the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to protect the freed slaves from discriminatory state laws and grant them a citizenship status, you know, as previously discussed. And here's a slaughterhouse case of 1872, where the primary holding was the privileges and immunity clause of the 14th Amendment is limited to federal citizenship rather than extending to state citizenship. Now, there's a clear distinction that they recognize two separate political statuses, and one is superior to the other. A U.S. citizen, U.S. citizens are federal citizens. The only citizenship mentioned in that amendment is to the jurisdiction, the, in quotes, specifically, the jurisdiction thereof, as the federal government citizens, as in the federal government citizens of the United States. Now, that's where the 14th Amendment tried to bring us all in under that same umbrella as subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And
Al?
Yes.
Sal from Colorado.
Yeah, go ahead, Sal.
All right, my question about this, the jurisdiction thereof, what is their jurisdiction?
Okay, remember in the 13th Amendment, you know, it talked about the servitude of, how'd it go? It went, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, okay? Mm-hmm. Or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
Again, what is their jurisdiction, or the jurisdiction of the federal government?
Well, okay, you've got state citizenship, which is basically you are recognized as basically the creator of government, and you got their jurisdiction where you have been brought in and have been given basically a political class citizenship as a federal citizen and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And this is where you are subject to that, the statutes, codes, rules, and regulations, you know, of this here United States and its subcorporations, state ofs. That make sense?
Yes.
But there's
I understood all that. I'm asking, where did they get their jurisdiction? Where, you know, it doesn't state like it's a territorial jurisdiction.
You mean for the federal citizen?
Yeah.
Okay, for the federal citizen, this is where basically, you are granted that status through the 14th Amendment by the government. Okay, so it is the government that is grants and protects, gives them civil rights, and civil rights is basically that granted by statute in the civil law. And you know, being a state national, you know, we are basically sovereign. We are one of the people that basically, you know, created the Congress, which actually established this legislation where it talks about that Congress should have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So they use legislation as the enforcement to recognize that class, that is a specific class of citizenship, that federal citizenship. So that's how they did it. But you know, being a state citizen born in the country, you know, within a state, you know, you are considered a national, and those, all these statutes, codes, rules, and regulations really don't apply.
Correct.
So, I don't know if I'm explaining it good enough, or...
No, no, that's what I know, that being a state citizen, a national, as you're calling it, we are sovereign. That's why there's tons of court cases stating that we are sovereign, because we are state citizens, and that's
with a capital C. Yeah, the definition of the United States of America in Bouvier's Dictionary of 1856, it's a five-page writing, and I put it up several times here before, but it is something good to read. You can pull it up, and I believe it's 3,071 to 3,075, those pages. But it breaks it down pretty clear, the authority and the distinction of where that authority rests. So, is there anybody else with a question or comment? If you're muted, you got to press star 6 and then mute when you're done so we can keep a clear recording. Does that answer your question,
Hello?
Sal?
Hello?
Yes.
Who's that? I was muted. I muted myself.
Yeah. Who is that one that had a question?
This is Gigi.
Yes, Gigi.
Good evening, everyone. The story has it that the 14th Amendment was never ratified. However, Roger says that even so, because it's been accepted, it's like it's gone on for so long, like acquiesce, so the ratification argument doesn't really hold too much water on that. Would you agree?
Well, I guess my thought is when they put the legislation, put this in place through the executive order 100, which put the legislative law above common law, and they basically did it through court martial or martial law, where they've got, you know, they forced Congress back, you know, to come back, and the only way they come back is if they ratified the 13th and 14th Amendment. And so it was really implemented basically through military rule, so to speak, is my comprehension on that thing.
I have my problem with it. Fraud is fraud from the beginning. And not ratifying an amendment is fraud, or
ratified. Yeah, it's been basically recognized for the last,
40,
70 years. Well, what are you going to do to change it? I mean, so you got to take that to the court to change it, if you want to change it. So, but they have recognized this here, and this is what they've been doing in this feudal system. We've been operating in a feudal system, you know, all this time. And, you know, getting into understanding, you know, the feudal system is really to understand how all this stuff was tied together, where we are really not operating, so to speak, we're still operating under a constitutional Republican form. It's still there, but they're operating as a legislative democracy under war power. And this is where basically it talks about the Lord of the Manor. And in Ballantine's, you know, it talks about the feudal estate of the Lord, Barony, or the Lordship. And they tie us into the Lord of the Manor, which is the proprietor or owner of the manor. So who's the owner of the manor? Well, we're operating as a corporation. That's the manor. And then they're holding us as basically a tenant, which is one who occupies the premise of another or subordinate to the person of another's title, where you know, we think we buy land, and down in the mortgage contract it says that you're a tenant. And it always identifies us, are we a resident, which is one who resides in a place, or one having either legal residence or domicile. So what's legal? You know, this is, you know, kind of recognized, you know, through their legislative process and stuff. And this is why when we have our correct political status recognized, then we fall into a different status as not subject to that jurisdiction thereof, which they encompass everybody else that participates. You know, we fill out, you know, kind of through intimidation and threat, a lot of people, you know, fill out a 1040 form. Are you a resident? Are you a citizen of the United States over the age of 18? You check any of them boxes, boom. And then down on the bottom, I declare under the penalties of perjury that the above is true and correct. Wow. You confirmed your political status right there. The same when you register to vote. You register into this federal voting recognition to be one of these members of the corporation and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So it's there, but we have to recognize our correct status so we can be separated from that subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So
instead,
I hope that
of voting, we have the right to suffrage. It's in our constitutions.
Well, that's voting. Voting is suffrage.
We have the right to suffrage, not voting.
Okay. Yeah, we can, or we can participate, or we don't have to participate. It's not mandated.
Correct.
But when you register, you're declaring your political status. You know, whether you know it or not, you are basically identifying which side of the spectrum you're wanting to be on by participating. If you want to get on the bus, you can get on and go for the ride, or you can stay on the ground.
That's why I haven't voted in over 20 years.
Yeah.
May I?
Yeah, who is this?
This is Gigi again.
Okay,
thanks
go
for
ahead,
the call, dear. Yeah, thanks for this call. It's pretty informative for people, me included. I have a question before we get too far off with the election stuff and the voting stuff. You mentioned with mortgages and how when people do their signature / autograph, they want to not be under penalties of perjury by signing something that doesn't identify them as a national. And you mentioned mortgages, which sparked a question I have. When on the mortgage loan application, the options they give you, one of them, is this correct? One of them says, some kind of application
for a business loan. Citizen of the United States.
Citizen of the United States.
Mm-hmm. And I could pick one that listed only two of the islands you listed earlier. The Mariam Islands was one of the two listed, I believe, and I forget the other one. It might have been Guam, but I just glanced at it once.
Virgin Islands? Guam?
Guam
is usually the listed.
Yeah, I think it was Georgian Islands, I think was the other one. But there's only two islands listed, and it didn't have another comma after it. Like, the list continues. I kind of searched pretty thoroughly and decided not to submit that page of the form and stop there. But are there ways to make – I need to get hooked up with the proper way to handle running corporations or the business – the type of entities that I need to be running, because I've got a small corporation open, not an S-corp, but a small corporation open, but I don't want to have to pay taxes on an utter lack of profit for 3 years.
Yeah.
Like, I need to be moving forward dealing with getting my daughter's
right, right. So, stepping back a minute, when people go to do business with, say, a loan of some sort, and there's not an option for checking off a person's status.
Or national with nothing after it, which I refused to check on a different section of it. That was the other thing that was on.
It did say
national. The other option was national with nothing else on it on a different pull-down list. Like, just national. And so I looked up national and heard what I heard earlier today, which is not something I want to check. Just the word national by itself.
Would it be okay to check this national by itself, or does it have to be something like American national or state?
I think national by itself. But see, in that definition that I read earlier, it said national of the United States. Okay? In quotes.
Right.
And that is the same as basically a U.S. citizen in...
Right,
in,
of the federal corporation, yeah.
Yeah.
In their definition.
What if it said national, American national, or a state citizen?
Well, they,
would that be okay?
I've never seen a form that said state citizen.
Okay.
And,
I haven't either. I just thrown it out there. Has anybody, like, made some application for some kind of loan and then made their own insert?
Well, I don't know that that would be accepted by the bank. See, the banks are very touchy with this kind of stuff. And
okay.
And that's why, you know, we need to understand that we are a bank and how to access our credit. I mean, these are things maybe will be ironed out here in the near future, Lord willing.
Right. And, I'm kind of familiar with those branches of things as not wackadoo. And I'm just wanting to do this in the right order. And I've never heard your call before. And honestly, I've never heard anyone speak about this stuff that was completely accurate on their stuff to you. So thank you for doing your homework. And how do I find more of your stuff? Because I'm in pretty intense John Arthurass stuff, like business training right now, like pretty intense most days. How can I find your stuff? I just filed my papers with the Secretary of State, like, earlier, yesterday. It's been a long 24 hours.
You mean as filing as a corporation, you mean?
No, I filed my national citizenship status affidavit.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay. I don't know. I strung words together that described it. I hope I used the right words.
Affidavit.
Yep. You know, that's very critical, but just understanding this here, and if you've got any, you know, just if you're not really sure or confident enough, you know, to know exactly where you're at, you know, I would suggest that you join Roger Sales calls during the week, you know, if you can get on. It's from, it'd be from 9 to 11 Mountain Time, but... Gigi knows about it, but that, you know, and you can get into some open discussions there and get your questions, you know, answered too, to get you a further understanding. Roger's very grounded in this, and
Darryl,
he's probably even more fluent than me.
I've listened to his stuff a little, and some of his stuff he gets going and it's spot on to me, and some of his stuff is not someplace I want to feel like I ever need to go.
It can be confusing.
To each their own. It's cool. I don't really feel as confused as just not, like, wanting to be led certain directions or certain levels of perspective.
Well, we only listened to the archive for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we took off on another.
Well, what helps is to really study this stuff, and Devin put together the 71 pages, which if you read that, you know, there's a few, you know, overall, it's an absolute, a good, great document. It brings up a lot of important issues. There might be a few places where it has 10 square miles rather than 10 miles square.
Right.
Or a capital letter or something like that, maybe a change that, but. You know, the whole thing is that we need to study to show thine own self approved, a workman rightfully dividing the word of truth. And this is where, you know, when we discuss this and have these open calls and stuff like that for people to you know, get in and ask questions, and we get we're more grounded in knowing why we believe what we believe, and that's very important that we understand it to the point that we can defend it.
Yes.
Daryl, may I?
I totally agree. I think it was clinically insane, possibly, of me to file my affidavit, but my gut told me to file it and get swimming. So I am trying to swim carefully, but also I feel like the sharks in the water are misinformation itself, and so I'm really trying to be careful and then deep dive. I have actually a copy of, I believe, 5th edition Black's Law. My teacher was kind of mad. I got it pretty inexpensive, but I sort of put it out to the universe and bought one for like $100 or something like a year ago. And I'm not wanting to hide out by myself with the book because that's going to take too long, it feels like. So what I'm looking for is a good structure where I can touch on it and just know that I have my homework to do. Go in and grab it so that I can study this rapidly but well.
Okay, well, on the notice, yeah, just Paul wants to say something.
Sorry, thank you.
Hey, Paul?
I just wanted to share that the Radio Ranch show is from 9 to 11 Eastern time, and you said 9 to 11 Mountain, and I think Andy also has a comment.
No, it is 9 to 11 Mountain time. It's 11 to 1 Eastern time.
It is 11 to 1 Eastern, Paul.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Well, maybe I had it backwards.
I'm trying to break in. I was trying to break in for you, Paul.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Lisa has a question, too.
Okay. Lisa?
Thank you.
Okay. So, if their term national is owing permanent allegiance to a state, and you're trying to come out of the feudal system, changing one allegiance to another, how does that work?
Well, you're basically where all these here statutes and codes that all the, like the citizen of the United States political status is subject to that District of Columbia territory and in cellular possessions, and how they're holding us there is basically through the registration of the birth certificate, and then they warehouse it in the District of Columbia, and then they say we reside, or basically we reside out here in the States and are a resident. And this is where, residence is basically having, you know, either legal residence, you know, is really not ownership, but they try to hold us in the capacity of a tenant. And then subject to their...
to removing yourself from the federal jurisdiction, but then you're turning around and saying you have allegiance to the state, which is still the feudal system?
Well, there's a little difference between state and state of, but... being like the lord of the manor, that's like this, like the corporation. And this is where the feudal system holds us in this capacity, you know, basically through democracy of the voting and mob rule type of situation and their control tactics through registration and this kind of stuff where they get you to declare under the penalty of perjury that they give you a couple options. Are you a resident? Are you a citizen of the United States? You know, and when you check that, you're basically acknowledging that you are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Unless you do it, you know, basically through agency, you know, where you're doing it on behalf of the entity. Because that citizen of the United States status is basically the entity that they created, and it's basically a vessel that's used in commerce to basically transmit property rights. But we've got rights and property as well as we've got property and rights. And it is the property and rights that, you know, we are able to defend more effectively as a national or a state citizen. Because then we are recognized as basically the one, the creator, you know, of the government that is in place, and not a subject of where you're asking for permission and basically applying to be a citizen of the United States. You know, like they did with the blacks, where they were brought in, you know, and then held as slaves. And then this is what this was all about. But when they brought in that second 13th Amendment, what they did is they outlawed involuntary servitude, but they allowed us to be voluntary servants or voluntary slaves if we don't know the difference. And that's what Harriet Tubman basically identified. She said, "I freed 1,000, I could have freed thousands more if they only knew they weren't slaves, or if they only knew that they were slaves." You know, like I explained right at the beginning. But this is the battle that a lot of people are in today here, and it's hard to convince people to believe something that they don't believe even exists. You know, well, people are starting to feel the pinch a little bit more as things tighten up a little bit more, and they're starting to recognize that something's not quite right. But, you know, these younger generations, as long as they got a car and a, you know, $20 bill in their pocket to go out for the weekend or whatever, I mean, that's good enough. You know, I'm free. Just go live for the day. You know, this is where education is so critical, that, you know, if we don't know who we are and what our correct status is, we could be sucked up into the whirlwind and basically get treated like one of these volunteer slaves without even, you know, recognizing how or why. And this is what we're trying to point out. Does that help?
That's a question. May I ask a question,
Lisa,
about the residents?
Lisa, did that answer your question?
Yeah, it helped. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, sure.
What is the significance of this residence? I think that's some form of res or something. Why is that so important when they ask you, are you a resident?
It's one who resides in a place, okay? Now, they're holding you as if they hold you as that 14th Amendment citizen of the United States, which basically is subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which is all the statutes, codes, and rules and regulations that really apply to the District of Columbia and its territories. And when you are residing, you reside as a resident. You're residing out here in one of the territories, and then they are holding you. If you acknowledge that you're a resident of the United States, then basically this is a place where you're occupying or you're living.
It's almost like a confirmation of a status. You're a resident of the United States.
Yes, it is. It is confirmation of a status in the way they imply it.
Yeah. And
I think
I can
clarify that.
Just hold on.
Paul wants to respond. Go ahead, Paul.
It comes from ambassadorial law. Like if a citizen or an ambassador of Uganda is at the embassy in the United States, he is said to be in residence. So he is in residence at the embassy in the United States, but he is still under his home country's laws. And with respect to how it works with the United States, if you're a 14th Amendment citizen, you're a citizen of the District of Columbia, of the federal state, but you are in residence in one of the outlying territories or outlying possessions, which are the political subdivision states, the state of Colorado, state of Minnesota. It's not Minnesota state or Colorado state. That is the de jure state, the republic state. The state of Nevada is a corporate subdivision that overlays the de jure state.
Correct.
Covers it.
And that's,
how does one get that
at,
clarified?
And that's
clarify
at
that?
Law. That corporation, it sits at law. And there's the difference between the 11th Amendment, which was created by Congress, which basically has a capital J judicial small p power, and the distinction of the Article 3 of the Constitution that talks about the small j judicial capital P power shall be vested in one small s supreme capital C court. There's a clear distinction in the two that was created with the Constitution. That is the authority of the national or the state citizen can exercise that in law in all cases affecting ambassadors and admiralty, maritime, in all cases. So that recognizes the authority of the sovereign. And the sovereign is basically recognized as a king or a queen, which is not subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So it's basically a political status, how we are looked at within our system of governance here in this country.
I think a good way to put it is that if somebody asks you if you're a resident, you say, "I am not in residence." You answer them properly. I dwell in my home state of New York, or in my home area, New York State. But I am not in residence, because that's what they're really trying to do. They're trying to take the statutes, acts, and codes that get their teeth from the federal government and impose them on you. So, I mean, if you're a 14th Amendment citizen, the statutes, acts, and codes from the states, they apply to you because you're a 14th Amendment citizen. Because the state is a political subdivision of the federal, okay? The federal statutes, acts, and codes apply to you. And because the state is a political subdivision of the federal, the same statutes, acts, and codes apply to you as well. But if you're not in residence, if you are a free man, if you dwell on the land, then you're not a resident. You occupy. You don't reside.
See, citizen of the United States it meant something different prior to 1868, before the 14th Amendment. But then after the 14th Amendment, then they start trying to tie it all together. And they try to mold, basically with the equal rights and all this here, and they use the slavery issue to bring this about, where now it is only the involuntary servitude that is recognized, but that opens the door to, if you want to be a volunteer slave, I mean, just participate, and they will hold you in that classification and hold you subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And this is what they have done, and they've tricked us, and even like a driver license. I use that because that's a very common one, that we have a right to travel. We can ingress and regress from state to state without interference, but yet, when they hold us as a driver, which is basically conducting commercial business using the roads and using it for profit or gain, that's what the Commerce Clause deals with regulating commerce. And this is where they're trying to tie us in to try to get us all that if we don't have a driver license, and then we make, and then they're trying to hold us as being subject to the jurisdiction thereof as being a citizen of the United States defined by the 14th Amendment, and are holding us subject to that jurisdiction thereof. And this is basically their word art and trickery, and they don't teach us this stuff in school. And this really entraps us into believing something that is really not a fact. But they're holding us through threat and intimidation into the status that if we don't have one, they're going to pull us over, they're going to beat us up, and they're going to tow our car and maybe throw us in jail, and then require us to put up ransom to get let go out of the cage or to receive the car back. And this is basically how they're treating us as an enemy of the United States. And this is basically back in March 9th of 1933, where they declared basically all persons to be enemies of the United States. And the citizen of the United States is basically identified as a person. And remember, the 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction. And when you go into the statutes and codes, when you read those there, it will identify person. You'll very seldom, if any, see the term people or sovereign. It will always be, it'll always identify the person. And this is basically where those statutes and codes and rules and regulations apply. It applies to that entity that was created or registered by the buyer through the federal system. And that was, you know, done, you know, through the birth certificate registration, you know, maybe a Social Security application, a voter registration application. All these things are presumptions that they're holding us into that jurisdiction and making us subject to it because we didn't know what our true political status really was. And that's why it's so important to get this into the record and to get that passport card, which will identify you, and that will be of record. That is basically you, you know, as a national and not a U.S. citizen subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So I'm probably repeating myself. Was there another question? Anybody?
May I ask a question?
Go ahead.
I have a quick comment. I just have a quick statement. I just dropped a document in the chat, and it's the 1938 congressional record of the Senate hearings when they were talking about the Constitution and how they were going to, what they were going to include and what they weren't. The pages of interest are 10 through 14 in that PDF document because it talks about property, it talks about jurisdiction, and it talks about the federal authority versus the state or sovereign authority. And pages 10 through 14, it's probably about a 45-minute read because the writing is pretty small. But it's the link for it is in the chat if Phyllis can grab it and maybe attach it to the next email. I'll also throw it up on docs.usaorganicrepublic.com. I'll upload it up there.
Okay.
So. All right. That was all I had. Thank you.
Okay. Well, was there another question here? Otherwise, we'll
yes.
Would not the
evidence of the birth certificate, which is also secured by a Social Security number with the name, the same related associated name that's on the birth certificate, would they not, which is also the same, name that's on the driver license, which is also the same name on all the entity accounts for the bank accounts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, utility accounts, et cetera, et cetera. Would that not just simply indicate that you are a United States citizen?
Well, it puts you under that presumption, and that's why it's important to use the word by in front of your name, B-Y colon. That's where you're doing it on behalf of the entity that's named on there. And, you can put authorized representative, A period, R period, or something like that, and then...
So that signifies that you are the entity.
No, that signifies that you're doing it on behalf of that entity.
Yeah, that you're authorized to do it, and you have interest in that entity.
Well, I mean, it's basically your vessel that is used in this feudal system. There was another question.
Yes, I'd like to make a comment on this area you're speaking on. Years ago, I found out about filing a doing business as in Minnesota. And I went ahead and did it and didn't realize the importance of it. So I started diving. In Indiana and Colorado. In Indiana, they call it assumed name. And in Colorado, they call it a trade name. And in both those states, it actually says in their codes or statutes, whatever, it's in there, that if a person doesn't file a trade name, they can be penalized. And I can see the logic in that. So most often, depending on what I'm putting my autograph slash mark signature on, because I'm registered in Colorado with a trade name, which I think it's like $5 to apply for one. I think Indiana was $50, but you never have to file again after that. And there's a little bit of a process to it. You have to run it in a newspaper for 3 weeks and then get it recorded with the Secretary of State. And there's a renewal. They usually send you a renewal notification that you need to renew every year. And they send you can get a copy of it, so you a certified copy of it offline when you file it and when the expiration, all that. So to me, that goes along with the signature that I'm operating by their rules in commerce to do business. Not so much. It's me. It's like having a pawn. I see it like a pawn piece. Like I can move through commerce, doing business as, and not be. Correct. Yeah, like a vehicle. Yeah, moving through commerce. Yeah. Well, so. And then I used to put UCC 207 until it got changed to UCC 1-308, but anymore because I'm now on the record with the Secretary of State of being a national, I don't feel like I have to put the UCC anymore. But the doing business as, to me, it's good communication between relationship in the business world. It's the entity that they can deal with, they can recognize.
You created a trust? Is that what you did?
No, I haven't worked on that. I'm just doing business as. Their statutes say, you can be penalized.
That's my second question. What entity form is best for a national to do business without accidentally throwing themselves back into the pretend jurisdiction of the IRS.
Yeah.
Especially with some more recent updates to the business regulation.
Yeah, Brent Winters, they say, is a good guy to go to for trust. Anyway, that's all I wanted to comment on. Thanks for letting me have my 2 cents worth.
Okay, The trust document that I shared at the beginning of the year, the first two classes of this year, there is a certificate of assumed name on that. And that's when what you're doing is you're creating a whole nother entity to do business through. And the business is basically another vessel. And this is how they're using your name, you know, in this here capacity as a vessel also, as a citizen of the United States. It's all capital letter warehoused name that is in the District of Columbia. And you're just acting, you know, as an agent, or you're acting, you know, on behalf of that entity as basically an authorized representative or executor or however. Depends on what you're doing and how you would like to identify that association. So.
But is it still associated with the birth certificate entity?
That birth certificate entity, yes, it is. It's like you got two hats. You know, you could wear a headdress one day, and you could wear a cowboy hat the next day, and you could wear a baseball cap the next day. You're wearing different hats, but you're still the same.
Still the same head.
You're still the same man.
Yes, I understand. I'm a very dirty-looking man, but I understand.
Okay. We can kind of go through this here conclusion, and we probably need to close out then, because that's the reason why we started half hour earlier, so it don't get so long, because those on the East Coast, it gets pretty late. So let me read through this here conclusion, and this will kind of discuss a little bit of this here. The U.S. citizenship status was created after the Civil War, when the 13th Amendment wasn't enough to ensure the proper treatment of ex-slaves. While slavery was abolished by the 13th Amendment, Southern states would still pass local laws prohibiting Negroes from participating in their states or receiving proper benefits from their states. Even then, the 14th Amendment, Negro slaves did not qualify to become American citizens, short of the modification to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment then was passed, and the U.S. citizen status was born. This status transferred primary citizenship from individual states to the Congress and the federal government for those who bore this status, which allowed federal government the power it needed to protect Negroes from states with discriminatory laws. These protections, however, were limited at first, as Jim Crow laws were passed in the individual states that restricted the tightly controlled alien U.S. citizen Negro citizens relative to state citizens. When we then had two types of political statuses in the nation, the U.S. citizen, who were granted civil rights and protections under the 14th Amendment, and state citizens under the original Constitution and other founding documents of our nation, which pre-existed the 14th Amendment, who were people of each state with full political rights, basically like electors. When the legal precedent given by Brown versus Board of Education, the separate but equal doctrine, was eradicated and the rights of a U.S. citizen was equalized with that of a state citizen, which disallowed the states to treat their citizens differently than U.S. citizens. To this day, U.S. Code clearly declares that all persons, quote, all persons within the jurisdiction of the United States shall enjoy the same rights as white citizens, unquote. This perspective on history is further confirmed by the case U.S. versus Juan Kim Ark, the slaughterhouse case, which makes it quite clear that U.S. citizenship is federal citizenship. Now we got the background down. Is a U.S. citizen or a citizen subject? Question mark. Well, the United States Code specifies quite clearly that the U.S. citizen owes permanent allegiance to the United States, which means they are a citizen subject who is subject to Congress, which is the legislation, and the federal government to protect against their state. This is a classic formula of allegiance. But what is the other citizenship status, this state citizen? And we'll go into that next week. But, you know, this here, being subject to the jurisdiction thereof is basically determined based upon your political status. And that's why it's so important to make that declaration that we are identified in that class that is not subject to that legislative jurisdiction. And see, this goes back to Lincoln in 1863 under that War Powers Declaration that he did Executive Order 100, which put this legislative law above common law in Lieber Code 13. And this is a very important thing that we need to recognize, you know, to be not subject, you know, to this tyrannical mob rule type of situation where they're controlling everybody through this legislative process under war power, as basically identified with that gold fringe flag that we are operating under military law, through enforcing legislation through military law. So with that, we probably need to close out. If there's any last questions, I'll try to answer them quick. Is there anybody that's got a question? If you're muted, you got to press star 6. Otherwise, we'll close out for the evening.
May I ask, I had something really big outside that I had to deal with. I might have missed it. But the passport. When is it going to be clarified finally? When do you put in the last box field, U.S. citizen or national? What is the appropriate way to fill out that? And is there going to be a show on the birth certificate to fill on each numbered field? What is the correct thing to put in each field?
Well, you can go to Copper Moonshine Stills, or there's another one that you can do, and they explain that very well. And you know, but we want to kind of get covered and get clarified on this status issue, because this is a very key thing, and we can't do all this. We've went over this a few times before, but have you went to Copper Moonshine Stills and looked at what he's done?
I'm talking about the new updated, not the old fashioned stale stuff, the newest.
I can't change all this stuff. I can't change all this stuff, Stephen. You know, we have to study, you know, to understand what we're putting in each box and to know who we are. You know, we can't depend on somebody else to determine who we are.
Yeah.
We have to know what we're checking when we put these here little marks in these boxes and what we're declaring our status to be. So
yeah, you know, well, somebody mentioned, I think it was you, somebody said that if you check a national, that means American Samoa. When you track it down, it looks like
no,
American
that don't
Samoa.
Mean it doesn't say that. It says non-citizen national. If you check non-citizen national, that's an American Samoan.
But there's only, isn't there only two boxes, U.S. citizen and national? There's not, is there a non-citizen national?
I would have to look at, I would have to look at the form. I don't have
on
it in front of me, and I haven't looked at it for quite a while.
Is this the passport application he's talking about?
Yes.
Yes.
The passport application only asks you if your parents were citizens. And Copper Moonshine Stills is probably going to suggest that you say your parents were not citizens. But if they don't have an affidavit on file, or you can't prove
right.
that they weren't U.S. citizens, you do not want to put that on that form, because you don't want to lie on the passport app.
It's a tricky
thing.
It's not easy.
It's not what?
It's not easy to do that. I mean, for somebody to go through there, if you have 100% of these people that are on the show here and they need to go through it and make a DS-11 or whatever it is passport, how many percent of those 100% of those people are going to get it wrong?
What you need to
right?
do is this is why it's important to know who you are and what you're doing and read the directions, because you're basically getting your political status acknowledged to be recognized within that federal Secretary of State office, which is authorized to determine status for a passport. And that is where you attach this affidavit onto your application, and that will make this part of your record with the passport office, that you are, your desire and intent, you're declaring your desire and intention to be a national and not a citizen under the voluntary servitude status of the 14th Amendment. And it can't get any clearer there. There cannot be any misconception of your status when you attach that to your passport application. So with that, we're going to need to close out. If there's anybody new on the call that does not receive the notices for the Tuesday or Thursday night calls and would like to receive them, you can send an email to Phyllis. She'll give out her email here in a little bit. She'll want your first name, your state, and who invited you to the call, and a phone number. But we do not share any of your contact information. But if somebody would want to reach out to you, they would send an email to Phyllis and tell them that they would like to communicate with you. And then Phyllis will pass that communication on to you. And then it'll be up to you at your convenience to contact them if you want. So. Phyllis, would you want to give out your email quick?
Yes. It is blueridge1121@gmail.com. blueridge1121@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, thank you, Phyllis.
This is Stephen. I'd like to reach out to some people out there and have some fellowship, communicate with some people. If somebody would,
well, you
got
to do it just what I announced earlier. You send a notice to Phyllis, and Phyllis will pass that on. And if they want to communicate with you, then they will have to reach out to you.
Okay, send it out to the group, right? Steve?
No. She will send it. She will, whoever you are wanting to communicate with, she'll pass it on to them, and that will be.
I don't know who
the,
everybody's names are out there. I hardly know anybody's names that I hear
well,
on this show.
Then. I mean, this isn't like a free for all.
Daryl,
some people
Daryl,
have.
Daryl.
Yes.
This is Kent.
Yes, Stephen.
If Stephen wishes to talk to me, he can contact.
Yeah,
Phyllis.
I'd like to speak to you, Ken. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Contact Phyllis, and she'll give me your number, and I'll call you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Stephen,
appreciate that.
Where in the country are you?
Pennsylvania.
You're in Pennsylvania. Okay, if there's any other callers, if there's any other people here in the Pennsylvania area,
contact Phyllis.
Contact Phyllis and reach out to Stephen. This is Paul from the Radio Ranch. You might
Hi,
actually,
Paul.
If
Thank
you can get 21 of you together, You might actually have the very first citizens grand jury, de jure grand jury in the U.S., in the state of Pennsylvania, where it all started. Would that be cool or what?
Yeah, that would be great. You know, there is something.
When you're all recognized as nationals.
One quick thing. What's called the Unabashed Self-Promoter's Guide by Jeffrey R. Lant is a book. I bought that years ago, but you can get it for free now as a download. It tells you how to get free publicity. If you wanted to do something like that, grand jury, et cetera, boy, it tells you how to get in touch with the newspapers and how to put a press release out and make an article and send it out to all the newspapers, and they'll publish it for free.
Okay. Yeah, anyway, you know, to set up a grand jury or a trial by jury, you know, when you do this here, there's always a jury qualification. And on a trial jury, a jury trial like they have today in this here corporate system, basically what they look for is they draw that jury pool from the voter registration list or your driver license registration. Say they're attaching you as that 14th Amendment subject, servant, slave. And that's why you would have to fill out a jury qualification list, and it would be great to be recognized into the system, in the record, as a national or a state citizen. So
I would see it happen if you have a birth certificate.
Okay. Well, with that, we need to close out. So, Heavenly Father, we just come before you to thank you, Lord, for an opportunity to come together and to learn the different things that we can apply in our life to be set free from the tyranny of this here legislative system that are holding us under war power. We ask you, Lord, for wisdom as we go forward and in dealing with the different confrontations in our local communities. We just pray, Lord, for this country that there be a spiritual awakening and that people will be drawn back to the principles you give us to follow. We ask you, Lord, for strength and for good health, for healing of this nation and for all those that who have been falsely incarcerated and are dealing with many health issues from the circumstances that have been brought about these last few years. And we just pray, Lord, that you'll continue to lay it upon our hearts to help one another, that we can work in harmony one with another as one body in Christ, that we can be recognized once again as being one nation under God with liberty and justice for all. And we just pray that you deliver us from this force of darkness. We ask that you continue to prepare the way before us and just strengthen us for the journey that we can endure until the end, that what is done is for your glory in the name of Yeshua. We commit all things into your hands. Amen. Well, thank you all for coming on the call. Pray that this here information tonight has been beneficial and that we can further understand it and apply it in our everyday, and that we can share it with others. And I encourage you to, you know, to share this information and to help more people be aware of this here, because I believe, you know, everybody wants to be free, but many of them don't even realize that they're slaves. And they need to know what the truth is. So I encourage everyone to share this information and to, you know, start maybe changing the talking points around coffee hour in the mornings and, you know, and people at their jobs where they start talking about, you know, what's the cause of all the tyranny that's been imposed upon the people. And we have to get to the source. And we have to see through the deception is the first thing. As this has been the great enemy, is the lies that have been cast upon us. And the greatest weapon against this deep state, is the truth. They hate the truth. When you present the truth, they scream and holler. And that's what has to be done. It is the truth that will set us free. So with that, we'll say goodnight all, and Lord be with you, and until we meet again.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
I thought that was the birthday cell. The birthday party going to start?
Yeah, it could
happy
be.
Happy birthday
party
Paul.
Starting.
Well, that's a celebration for the new extended show.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh,
well,
that's the start of the birthday celebration right there. Okay.
Happy birthday,
okay.
Paul.
Thank you.